From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys for this week. You're hearing my voice. You got Stu here. So you're thinking one of two things. You're thinking, if you're an older listener, where the hell have you been, Lacey? If you're a newer listener from this year, you're probably thinking, who the hell are you? So anyway, because you're probably most likely used to hearing Hunter and John and Eric for most of the time. Probably thinking, who the hell is this Stu guy? But I am back, finally, after 6 months and a shit ton of housework. But there is no Hunter this week. He is indisposed, like the Australian Crawl song is. And do have John here, though, faithful Tonto, over in Colorado. Yes. How you going, Johnny?
I never miss a show, or try not to.
You don't. You're like the... You know, the MMC is really like the Motorhead of podcasts. It just doesn't die and it just churns out shit all the time. We've actually gotten better. Of course, I have not been here since December last year, so probably wouldn't be as many episodes if I was here. I'm like, oh, can't make it this week. Oh, another day. So I've got to hand it to you, too. You really cranked out the episodes this year. I think this year has been the most productive in terms of episode count-wise in, probably of all time, probably in the 11 years we've been doing this. So,
yeah, I think it's the most consistent, at least since I've joined. And if you add in the Stu's views, it's we're really productive.
Yeah, they were sort of done at a William Shatner rate, you know, they're really slow, like the way Shatner talks, really slow, then really fast, and then really slow, then really fast. Right. Yeah. Just, I actually did have one recorder, but the mixer I was using, or my mixer, was just being a real shit, so I had to scrap it, unfortunately, but no matter. And one of those may turn up here and there when I've got something to say that I know you and Hunter just have no interest in whatsoever. They may turn up, but now that I'm back, they will pretty much grind to a halt. So, anyway, this time around, we're going to be doing the Miami Vice pilot film from 1984. When we found out that Hunter was going to be unavailable, I said to John, I think we've mentioned this before in the past, John, doing this one, haven't we?
Yeah.
Yeah,
we have this and Crime Story.
Crime Story pilot.
Cover the pilots.
Yeah, and well, I thought, well, now's a good time as any. I knew you had the set. I've had the set since God knows how long. And we said we want to do Crime Story or Miami Vice, and I think we agreed to Miami Vice. We'll do Crime Story as well sometime soon, I think. And we'll sort of put them back-to-back up against the Miami Vice one, because didn't they premiere around the same time, or was Crime Story a couple of years later?
Crime Story was a year later, I believe, a year or two later, because it was sort of like Michael Mann. I think he left Miami Vice after the first season, so he was just kind of producer, you know, in name only. And he developed Crime Story. That was his the next thing he wanted to build on. And the funny thing to note is he never directed any episode of either series.
No, he didn't, did he? He cashed those checks, though.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was his. I think it was his idea to have like Miami Vice. Like, he didn't create it. Anthony Yerkovich created it, who'd been a script writer for Hill Street Blues. And it's almost like they took that script and Michael Mann's like, okay, it's going to look like my TV show Thief or my movie Thief, and it's going to have that aesthetic, but it's going to be a weekly cop show and. But it's going to be done in my style. And I'm Brandon Tartikoff, the president of NBC at the time, asked me to make a show called MTV Cops. So this is what I've developed, and we're going to have real music. We're going to have the real songs, not covers, because usually when you would hear a popular song on a TV show back then, like say The Fall Guy or Magnum PI or something like that, it would always be a cover version. It was never the real
song. Oh, it was cheaper. That's why.
Yeah, yeah, it was much cheaper. And boy, they watched the budgets, but they were given free reign with Miami Vice. I think the budgets were like the highest on network TV at the time. It was all filmed on location in Miami. Nowadays, they would shoot some, and even back then, they would usually just shoot some second unit shots of the city would set in, and everything would be filmed in L.A. or Canada.
Canada.
yeah, right, depending on what's cheaper. But this was all filmed in Miami, used a lot of Miami locals, and it's a totally different approach. And it was not a hit when it aired, which is the funny thing. It
really
was scheduled against Dallas, which was like the biggest show on TV.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And then an odd thing happened that summer when they still had summer reruns. I don't think they do it anymore. Viewers discovered Miami Vice during the summer because Dallas did not do summer reruns because it was a soap opera. You know, basically they didn't, there was no reason to show the reruns.
No.
And so Miami Vice like dominated that time slot during the summer and sort of suddenly was like in the top 20 over the summertime. And that's one of the last times it happened because a couple of years later, everybody owned VCRs and that was never an issue. Mm. But so it's like it was sort of rediscovered. It had been renewed anyway because NBC liked the numbers and the demographics, like young people watched it. That's what they wanted. Basically just people not watching Dallas. And People Magazine picked Don Johnson as the sexiest man alive. I don't know if he might have been the first one. I can't remember when they started that silliness, but maybe they did it back in the 70s with Travolta. I'm not sure. But that helped spark a viewership because there was that SNL sketch where they did People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive like it was a beauty pageant.
Yeah.
And Ben was playing Peter Graves. And Mark Harmon was competing, and it was done like a beauty pageant because he was the host. And he got it, I think, a year later, 2 years later.
Yeah.
And they had Dana Carvey as John Travolta. Peter Graves introduces him as our first sexiest man alive. And it's, I think that's what Carvey premiered his John Travolta impression. It was pretty funny.
Yeah.
And, it was so that helped. And the next fall, Miami Vice took a big chunk out of Dallas's audience, first run. So people stuck with Miami Vice, wanted to see the new episodes. And I can't remember what year it was. Dallas did the It Was All a Dream season finale where Pam wakes up and sees Bobby in the shower and Patrick Duffy had been killed in the previous season. And it was all a dream. And so forget everything you saw. And that probably pissed off a lot of viewers. But Miami Vice started killing Dallas. And I think Dallas is pretty much mortally wounded by Miami Vice.
Did they have the Who Shot JR to sort of spike the ratings? Or was that previous?
That was during its peak. I think that was like 1981 or 82.
Oh, okay.
Dallas was like the hottest show on TV. It was a big export show. It was big in the Soviet Union. And it's credited with destroying communism because Soviet viewers would see this show that maybe the Soviet Union, you know, maybe the Kremlin or whatever thought, oh, it's going to show the excesses of capitalism and these are rotten people and everything, but they would see how people lived on TV
and
in
like,
Dallas.
This is,
and they go, how come we don't live like that? You know, and they were like, why is this JR? He lives good. You know, it's like, capitalism is wonderful. Bastards.
Larry Hagman, he live good life.
Yes.
We want same.
Yes, Larry Hagman. Yeah, capitalism quite good, actually. So, Dallas, Who Shot JR was their peak, and it was the dominant show on Friday nights for a few years. And then Miami Vice, that summer rerun season, basically pulled a leg off the table, put it that way.
All right. Because,
and eventually killed it.
Yeah, because this pilot movie, I kept thinking the pilot movie, and this is my mistake, was Calderon's Return. But when I put the disc in this morning, I just want to preface this episode, friends, by saying if I sound really scratchy, it's because much like Don Johnson's character of Sonny Crockett, who lives on 4 hours sleep, I've pretty much done the same today. I'm beyond wrecked, tired. I've actually had to hold up recording to tell John I need more coffee. Otherwise, I'm just going to fall asleep halfway through this, which I do not want to do. Oh, fuck, what was I saying? Okay, so I was watching the pilot episode one. I put it in and I'm watching it. I'm going, and it says Brother's Keeper. I said, this ain't Calderon's Return. Oh, shit, I put the wrong disc in. Fuck. So I had to flip through them. I'm going, what are you, Stuart, you're out of your mind. What are you doing? I had to go onto the internet and have a look. Brother's Keeper episode one. Calderon's Return. That's a few episodes in. Oh, okay, shit. So, anyway, I was about to message John going, I hope I haven't told you the wrong one to watch, because otherwise I would have completely screwed. I'm a fucking mess, John, at the moment. I really am. I'm so tired. Brother's Keeper, season one, episodes one and two, apparently won 2 Emmy Awards as well, out of the 3 was nominated for. Mm-hmm. So, not bad. Good little effort. Yeah.
And it was the first TV show to in my memory to look like a movie.
It really does. Yeah.
Yeah, especially action TV did not look like a movie back then. It was not cinematic at all. It looked like a TV show with cop action or a cop show, you know.
Like a Hill Street Blues. I mean, you couldn't have
put Hill Street Blues, Beretta, or, you know, this, something similar.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't have done a Hill Street Blues TV movie theatrically. You know, if you get 2 episodes and you patch them together and you make a 90-minute episode, you couldn't have screened it theatrically. It wouldn't have played well. But this Miami Vice one, and especially Calderon's Return, the two-parter, a few episodes later down the track, you could have played theatrically. I mean, you could have played... Splice this together, you know, remove a couple of things. Remove, please... Like cringe factor 1000 with this episode, especially in the first one, Philip Michael Thomas mouthing or miming Rockwell, somebody's watching me, was just fucking cringe factor on overload when he's in the strip bars. I just cut it. You didn't need it. It did no favors. But yeah, this one really, if you had to splice it together, you could have shown it theatrically, and I think this was shot, and clue me in, John, if I'm wrong, was this shot open mat in a 1-3-3?
TV back then was shot open.
Because so. I spotted the boom at least once, pretty prominent for about a second, so I'm figuring it was open mat with a 1.85 theatrical option if they went that way.
Right.
Yeah.
And if I have... Have they put these out on Blu-ray? I'm not even sure.
But they have.
If they did, they would probably do... Okay, they would probably do the 1.85 remaster like they did with the Kung Fu series.
No, they didn't. It is...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, no, it's only in the 1.33 open format for the Blu-ray, which the Blu-ray, I think, was put out by Mill Creek.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's been out for about 3 years now. And I look for it on... I mean, I've got the DVDs, I've got all 5 seasons, but the first 2 seasons are in these massive box sets. Of, you know, they're about half the size of my house, and they're just ugly on the shelves. I want them gone. I just want to get that Blu-ray set. But it sort of comes in and out on the market. It's available at a really decent price of 70 Australian bucks off Amazon. Then it disappears, and it skyrockets up to a couple of $100. You think, shit. It's like a game. It's like a game of whack-a-mole. You're trying to find this thing and get it before it disappears again. So, in the American market, I'm sure it's a lot easier to find and obtain for your home video shelf. But via the Amazon Australian site, it turns up here and there. But yeah, it is on Blu-ray, and it's on Blu-ray as well in the UK. But over there, their price is just astronomical. But Mill Creek did put it out.
Yeah, their shipping prices are dickish too, because of the whole COVID thing.
Yeah, well, we can only get over here. We can only get things via Amazon Australia. Mm-hmm. So, if something's available in the US store, you have to click on the link that says "Buy it on Amazon.com.au." Then it'll take you to the Australian site with the correct price and the GST added in, and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is available, and apparently the first wave of Blu-rays that came out had audio issues, but they've been corrected now, and from what reviews say, this, it looks really, really good. So the DVD versions, you know, man, the colors would look even better on the Blu-ray format. So I really want that set, but not the astronomical price they're asking.
Does it keep all the licensed music?
It does, yeah. Because obviously that was one of the things that was going to be brought up with, you know, the fans of the show was, okay, what about all the music? Much like WKRP in Cincinnati when that came out. Hey, what about the music? Much like was the Wonder Years. You know, what about the music? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't want to run into the library songs that they shove in there when they can't get the rights or something.
The funk soundtrack from Coffee being repurposed.
Yeah. Yeah, the Roy Ayers soundtrack. So, yes, it is available, but let's get into this episode. 1984, premiered in, I think it was September 84, if I'm not wrong, if I'm mistaken.
Yeah. I watched it. I watched the premiere as a young kid.
Oh, you watched it when it happened? Oh, nice.
Yeah. I loved it first season. I thought, oh man, this is the new thing. This is like a cop show that looks like a movie. And the pilot movie has blood squibs, which you've never seen on TV shows.
Really?
It was just a no-no, and they allowed blood squibs in that final shootout. And the interesting thing is, I was told this by Eric, because he remembered this when he was watching it, I guess in reruns or whatever. And he said, I noticed they didn't use squibs for the rest of the season for the episodes. And I said, I think you're right, because even as a kid, I noticed, oh, gee, there's no blood and people are shot point blank and everything. But there's no squibs in any of the regular episodes.
Even if
some of them get really violent and there's a lot of shooting. But they did not use blood squibs regularly. So they apparently were allowed something by a free license by standards and practices to allow for the squibs on that premiere.
Yeah.
Because I remember being really shocked. I was stunned that a TV show had, like, full squibs like Scarface.
Did I have any TV show? I mean, pardon my ignorance, I do not watch new TV shows. The last TV show I watched that was new was Deadwood. That's, what, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. Did they have that sort of blood factor these days? I know Rome was one that was pretty heavy fat, and Spartacus as well, but I don't know any others.
And Rome was HBO, so they got away with a lot. They could get away with a whole lot. Like that in Game of Thrones, they could get away with gore and killing kids or rape or open surgery with dirty shovels or whatever the hell they do on those shows. It's like they got away with a lot of stuff. I think that was part of the weird deviant appeal of those shows. But on network TV, CSI seems to get away with a lot with like the autopsies and everything, but
which CSI? There's about 18 of them. There's like tons of CSIs going there.
Yeah, there's like four or five, but like the original, I've only seen the original. I never watched the other shows. I tried watching CSI New Orleans and just thought it was terrible because it was like every cliche about New Orleans you could think of, like, oh, he plays saxophone in a jazz band at night. You know? Oh, he's eating gumbo. You know, it's just like tourist New Orleans or whatever. Is he drinking Jack's beer while he's at it?
And there's a murder on Bourbon Street.
Bourbon Street. It's like it's a special poison in the crawfish, you know. They've all got accents. They've got the terrible TV Cajun accent.
As a witch doctor.
The lead guy is part Cajun.
Speaking of that, we should, before I get you to give a summary of this this pilot episode, there were some really messed up episodes of Miami Vice to come further down the track, but the worst one was the one about the Haitian witch doctor. It was just ridiculous.
And I don't know if I saw that one.
Oh, it was just...
There was a point where I quit watching it, and then I started watching it again in its final season because I knew that was going to be end. And the rumor was they were going to die in the last episode, but it didn't happen.
Yeah, that's right.
But I remember I lost interest, I think, third season. And I believe Michael Mann had left the show, and Dick Wolf, future producer of Law & Order, had took over the show. And he was just kind of, you know, cranking them out at a fast rate. But I know John Milius wrote a script for one of them, Bikers from Mars or Bikers from Hell or something like that.
Right. Yeah. And there's a lot of guest episodes. you know, Stuart, a lot of guest actors and actresses on these episodes. The one that follows these two episode pilot has Ed O'Neill pre Married with Children. Ed O'Neill.
Yeah, he's an FBI man too in deep. I did watch that after watching the pilot.
Oh, okay. Season 2, episode 1 has, of all people, Gene Simmons and Penn Jillette as the two guest stars on the show.
Yeah, Ted Nugent's on an episode.
No way. Really?
Yeah, yeah. I think I remember he was like a guest, and I don't remember if he was like a drug dealer or, you know, he wasn't very Ted Nugent-y back then. He wasn't the Uncle Ted Nugent image. He was the 70s rocker Ted Nugent.
He and Don Johnson could have exchanged underage girl swapping stories.
Yeah,
I guess.
Underage girls and cocaine, I'm sure. Even though Ted went to it. But who else was on the show? Like Phil Collins made his acting debut. Oh gosh, a lot of music. Like Miles Davis apparently had an acting role on Miami Vice. I don't think if I saw it, I didn't know who Miles Davis was because I was like 13 or 14. I wasn't digging, Blue Note Jazz back then.
Yeah. At least I hope it doesn't have Gary Coleman in there. That would just fuck the show right up. Unlike Buck Rogers. Buck Rogers had Gary Coleman as some sort of galactic warlord. It was just ridiculous. I mean, I like the Buck Rogers show.
But he was like, Gary Coleman was like president of the galaxy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. What you talking about, Buck? What you talking about? No, they didn't get too cheeseball with the guests. When they had a guest, it was like a big deal. It'd be like Willie Nelson or somebody like that. It was actual, you know, real. It was cool. It was somebody you didn't usually see on television.
Yeah. But this is the only episode of the only series of Miami Vice where Don Johnson was clean. Apparently from season 2 onwards, he was just wasted all the time.
Oh, yeah. Well, his ego got big. He finally had a show hit big because he had been Mr. Failed Pilot. He had shot like 4 pilots and all had failed. Did not get this role.
I was going to ask you about Don Johnson. What was his career like before Miami Vice? I haven't seen much Miami Vice at all.
Okay. When he started, he was sort of like, apparently he was a very acclaimed stage actor. And, you know, he had been in Salomoneo's gay play or something that, you know, he did like an acclaimed performance in that. And he was good at, they wanted him as like a new James Dean type or something in the early 70s. So he's in The Herod Experiment, which is just some trashy early 70s sexploitation movie, and that's where he met Tippi Hedren. I guess she fixed him up with her 14-year-old daughter. Ugh. Melanie Griffith, or Don met her on the set or something. Supposedly Tippi signed off on that relationship. Really creepy. Don was 22, Melanie was 14, but he's not on trial here, so we'll move on.
No.
Then he's in A Boy and His Dog, which was a popular midnight movie cult sci-fi film.
Right.
Then he would do he's like in the sequel to Macon County with Nick Nolte, like before Nick Nolte was a big star. He would be in all these films and none of them were really hits. Like, and then he would do TV pilots and they wouldn't sell. And then he would do appearances on TV shows, but he was sort of like a working actor. Like I found out he has he worked in English dubbing. He dubbed like a Lupin the Third, animated movie, Mystery of Mambo, back in 1978. He's in the first original export dub. So he did like cartoon dubs and stuff. Like, jeez. He was just one of those guys had to pay the bills. And apparently he hung out with musicians like Dickie Betts and co-wrote songs with him. And he knew a lot of the rock stars. And so he was a hard partying guy.
Oh,
and he probably cruised on the underage groupies. Who knows? But Miami Vice is like his first hit because he had done movies before that, but none of them really were seen outside the drive-ins or anything. Like I remember he did one called Soggy Bottom USA, him and PJ Souls and Ben Johnson. It was a decent little comedy from the director of The President's Analyst, but nothing edgy or terribly memorable about it.
Right. Because like I said, I remember seeing a lot of stuff of him after Miami Vice, and there was one in particular, Dead Bang. That was a damn good film. Mm-hmm. Really liked that one a lot.
The thing is, he is a good actor, but he has that Missouri accent that I think may put some people off, particularly women. It's very grizzled, like he smokes a pack of Reds.
No, I don't think too many women got put off by Don Johnson accent.
Well, they may not like his voice. That's what I'm saying. It's like, no, I think they think he's hot. You know, he was a stud on TV, but certainly had no problem drawing the ladies.
Mm.
But you know, he's not a big guy, which doesn't really matter. None of them are. I recently found out Burt Reynolds was 5'7". So
really? Is that all?
I read an interview with an actress. She had done a Terrence Hill movie, a Terrence Hill and Bud Spencer film, Crime Busters. But she had also done a movie with Burt Reynolds, and she said he's 5'7". And she said, when I wear high heels, I'm like 5'11". And so I couldn't be in the same shots as him or whatever. It was actually Stick, the film we reviewed on the show about a month ago.
Yeah.
And she said he's 5'7". It could be a little inaccurate because it's English translated to German, translated back to English, so there might be a mistake there or whatever, but I don't think Burt was a tall guy. I don't think any of them were really tall. You know, even people we think of as tall, like Timothy Oliphant, you know, maybe they're just wearing boots and lifts and stuff, because there's a lot of, you know, short actors. It's, you know, maybe Liam Neeson's the only tall one. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But Don Johnson had that kind of, I don't know, it's hard to describe, but maybe he had problems being cast as an everyman, but because of his success on Miami Vice, and he threatened to walk, and they were going to replace him with Mark Harmon. I remember when that happened, because he was being offered movies left and right. He was offered The Untouchables. He was offered Die Hard, and he was ready to go get a movie career. And then they somehow I think Michael Mann actually stepped in and renegotiated, and he got like something like $1 million an episode, which was crazy money in the 80s.
My goodness.
It sounds like nothing now, but that's a high fee. And you'll notice, like, after Miami Vice, he always has steady work. Like, he'll have a TV show, like, Nash Bridges ran forever.
Nash Bridges was like fun. I really enjoyed that show a lot.
Yeah, that was a fun show. It was unpretentious, fun cop show, you know.
Yep.
What do you want to watch? You want to drown in misery with The Wire, or you want to just laugh and have fun with Nash Bridges? You're probably going to watch Nash Bridges on Friday night.
Don Johnson and Cheech.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, Don Cheech. And they're doing a reunion movie. There's a TV movie they're filming right now that's a reunion
movie. Oh, cool.
Yeah. We'll have to review that on the show.
Of course.
I've just found out he does there's a sitcom with Kenan Thompson, and Don Johnson has a regular role on there. Like, the guy is not hurting for work.
No. But, I mean, one of his films I really enjoy, and it's not good, but I really, really like Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man.
People love that movie, man. Don't act like it's anything to be ashamed of. That's a people's movie. That's a populist film right there. That's like the critics hated it and everything because they hate Mickey Rourke and they hate Don Johnson because they make money and have beautiful girlfriends or wives or whatever. But
yeah,
that movie is one of the most popular, like, just regular guys will tell you how much they love that movie.
Yeah, I'm one of them. Not ashamed to say it. I enjoyed it the first time. And again, it was one of those films that got like a 1-star review in the newspaper. I had to go and watch it at the theater. It's like,
yeah, there's your endorsement right there. it's perfect.
1992, I think it was 92 that film came out, or 94, one or the other. And I was working at the time. I would always scour the newspaper for the new film reviews on Thursdays. And Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man, 1-star. I was there that night. Went and watched
opening night.
I was only there with myself, and there was one other person. That was it. There was only two people in the whole theater. I'm sitting there watching it going, okay, it's not too bad. Hot chicks. All right. Keep going. Good movie. Get to the end. I really enjoyed the movie. What was the problem with this guy? Yeah. But he was a pretentious dickhead, that film reviewer. Lee.
Just a bunch of pencil pushing geeks.
Oh, these things. Just, yeah. He was this same idiot, was the same one who put me to Wes Craven's The People Under the Stairs. He gave it half out of five or something. It's like, okay, I'm there straight after work. Another film I really enjoyed. New Jack City, I think he gave like 1.5 straight to work, straight to the movies after work. Really enjoyed that one. So, yeah. But Harley Davidson is one that I really enjoy. But a lot of people say it's the film that really killed Don Johnson's career. I disagree. I don't think it did that much damage.
Probably because it wasn't a big theatrical hit, and I think like the advertising campaign wasn't really honest about what type of movie it was. It looked like a movie about two country singers or something, you know, with the posters and everything. They didn't really emphasize it as this crazy action movie. Which, by the way, that shootout with the helicopter, like through the building, was lifted shot for shot for The Matrix.
Was it really? I didn't know that.
Yes, every angle and edited shot, it's the same action scene.
Damn thieving Wachowski sisters.
There was a YouTube video that actually compared it. It was jaw-dropping. It was a complete lift.
Oh, my God. Lana and whatever the fuck the other one's name is, you...
Yeah, those two, whatever they are these days. Those transistors. Those transistors.
The transistors.
Transistors. That's what they are.
A bunch of portable fucking radios.
Yeah, those two, are they together? You know, is it incest?
Oh my God.
Transistors.
So yeah, that was and Don Johnson, he turned up in as the, was he the president or something in Machete Kills or Machete or something like that? Or was it was somebody? He was in the Machete.
I thought that was Charlie. Wasn't that Charlie Sheen?
In Machete? Don Johnson.
Okay, Charlie Sheen's the president in one of them. Is Don Johnson the president in another?
No, he's not the president. He's like the guy who he gathers up illegal Mexicans in a truck over from the border. And uses them as hitmen or something.
It was sort of like, it's probably because he was hanging out with Rodriguez or something. Rodriguez is probably a fan of Miami Vice.
Oh, I dare say so.
And then he was in Django Unchained, a Tarantino movie, is like a bitter clan leader with inept help or whatever.
Oh, that's right.
Which is actually it's a pretty funny scene. It's one of the highlights of the film.
Was he one of the
much for?
Was he one of the eight? Was he one of the eight in The Hateful Eight as well or not?
I never saw it. He might be in it. I'll
have to check it out.
The movie.
I got it, but I've still never seen it yet. It's the one that everyone just says it's god awful, so I still haven't.
Well, I'm told by people who love westerns like I do, it's terrible. Don't bother. And I'm told it's good by people who don't like westerns. So I kind of I can skip it. You know?
Okay.
And I don't think Tarantino has an eye for westerns, so you know I don't think he has a feel for the genre.
Yeah. Well, I don't like westerns as it's sort of well known on here, so I may enjoy it. I don't know.
Yeah, you might dig it. You might actually get something out of it. I just don't care. It what it does is it plagiarizes an episode of The Rebel, the Nick Adams TV show.
You're right.
And stretches it out to about 3 hours with gore and rape and God knows what else. And you know, I just nothing I care to see.
And foot shots.
Yes, probably some foot shots. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fit toes nice. Out of boots, whatever.
Okay, so let's get on to quickly about Philip Michael Thomas, which they always say never trust a man with three first names. What do we know about him? I know he dated Pam Grier during the Miami Vice period, which, good on you. More power to you.
No doubt he was a stud. He was like Don Johnson. He had been in the industry for like 10 years. Just he was a lead in a lot of B movies and had some prominent roles. Then he had bit parts in B movies. He was one of those guys that just never had a hit. And I don't think he ever did television before, or not frequently, you know, other than being guest villain, Arrested by Beretta or whatever.
Yeah.
But his time to shine, and you can tell in the pilot he's kind of he's really chewing the scenery in a lot of scenes and really doing a lot of like Pacino type stuff and everything.
Oh,
and he's,
he knows,
you know,
he's
doing different accents.
Yeah, there's this really good looking white guy here. I need to overshadow him in the scenes.
Right.
But okay. Yeah. So
well, also I should say that Don Johnson did not want to wear the Sonny Crockett clothing that I think was picked by Versace. And he wanted Crockett to dress like a cowboy or a biker.
Nah, wouldn't have worked.
That's what the script indicated to him.
You know? Nah, I can't see it. It's that look is iconic. It's actually associated with Don Johnson.
It was one of those things that shows you the actor could not picture what this was going to look like and how that was going to be appealing to everybody, that this was a new fashion thing for the 80s. And, you know, this is the way some beach bum would dress in Florida.
I just imagine the conversation. Gianni Versace, perhaps the most famous fashion designer of all time. Don Johnson, no, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm not wearing that.
Yeah. No, you should wear a cowboy hat.
You don't know shit.
Denim vest.
What do you know, Gianni? You don't know shit. All right. Okay, so give us a rundown of this pilot film. And I do want to say before I forget, the only thing I feel really, really missing from this episode is Edward James Olmos. Because I really liked his character that came along in Miami Vice, but he's not in this one. Is he even in the first season or season two onwards?
He's in the first season. Gregory Sierra, for whatever reason, either wanted to leave the show or was fired, so they killed his character about four or five episodes in, and he's replaced by Edward James Olmos. And Olmos comes in and plays a completely different character, like mysterious, you know, police chief or whatever he is.
Who just this really, stone-faced police chief who doesn't laugh, doesn't smile, nothing.
Yeah, yeah, he basically does a Charles Bronson impression the whole time. And
pretty much.
Apparently did not get along with Don Johnson because their acting styles were totally different, so.
Yeah. That would be one of the first things Edward James Olmos did, besides Blade Runner, obviously.
Right.
I think. I don't know. I may be wrong.
He was also in Zoot Suit. I think Zoot Suit was his big star-making performance, but wasn't a big enough hit to make him a name.
Mm. All right. All right, John, let's give us a rundown of this scene.
Okay, well, it opens in New York, and Tubbs is he's going after a Calderon, who is a kind of drug dealer and also, you know, apparently head of has a hit squad and everything, is responsible for the death of Tubbs's brother, which is revealed later in the episode. It opens with a Rolling Stones song, which really stunned me because I didn't catch it when I was a kid. I didn't realize that was a Stones song. I was like, geez, they actually got a Rolling Stones tune.
I know, right?
For a TV show. That was a big deal back then. And then Calderon gets away, goes down to Miami. Tubbs is infiltrating, as sort of a undercover cop. Cross paths with Sonny Crockett, who is the big vice cop, who is a former Florida State football player, who keeps an alligator, the college team's mascot,
Elvis,
on his boat. And the Elvis, who he said swallowed like a pound of LSD or 5 pounds of LSD or something. And so just chills out on his boat, which kind of gives it sort of a, I mean, maybe they threw that in there for the kids because they knew young boys were going to tune in on the show. I don't know. You meet the different characters. Gregory Sierra is their lieutenant or captain. I can't remember, you know, what it was. Look on here. You have dealings with an assassin played by an actor who later comes back to the show as a source, or, you know, kind of a squealer.
Squealer, yeah.
Yeah, they like the actor enough. They brought him back for a more comic role, which is he's really good. So you kind of have to let that slide when you watch the pilot, and then you see him come back in the show a few episodes later.
Yeah.
It turns out that Tubbs is after Calderon in Miami, and he teams with Crockett. And Crockett later finds out Tubbs has assumed the identity of his dead brother.
Raphael,
and that causes problems, but then somehow they still work it out, and you get everything set up for the TV show. So it's sort of, they're kind of doing a, what would you call it, fish out of water type thing with Tubbs.
Yeah, for sure.
Right, and then so it kind of just sets everything in motion for the TV show. So you have Calderon will be that villain that they're going to chase for episodes in.
Yeah.
Or he's still on Tubbs' mind for revenge. He gets away in the end. I'll give that away. I mean, I assume if you're listening to us, you probably watched the pilot.
We've mentioned there's Calderon's return, so he ain't coming back if he's dead. He can't return if he's dead for the...
Right. So.
Yeah.
So he's still mentioned or whatever, I think, in subsequent episodes, but then they do catch up with him. Let's see. You've got Olivia Brown as Trudy, And then you have Sandra Santiago as Gina Calabrese. So they're part of the squad, but it's not really clear because I thought they were like working in research or computers or whatever. And then I know in later episodes they do a lot of undercover work, although here it's implied they're posing as hookers later on, but you never see that.
Have you seen, John, Gina
had a relationship with Crockett. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you seen her in her later years, Sandra Santiago?
No.
What she looks like now? She is outstanding. For a woman who's 64, she looks like she's about 50. She looks fucking amazing.
Yeah, she looks good here. And
oh, yeah.
You know.
Very good-looking woman.
I think I saw a recent pic of her, and she still looked good. I was like, wow, she hasn't aged a bit.
No.
You know,
no,
obviously, was she 18? Was she one of Hun Johnson's underage girlfriends when she took the role back then?
No, she was 27.
Yeah.
27. Wow. Yes.
Yeah, so. And you also get Switek and... Zito, played by John Deal and Michael Talbot, and they're sort of the comic relief. And, you know, they kind of deflect from the tragedy when it happens because there's a witness killed who's played by, what's his name, Michael T. Williamson?
Yeah, Michael T.
Later had a big role in Forrest Gump, I believe, or something like that. Another movie I haven't seen.
Yes, he did.
And, there's some familiar faces here. It's like, it's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, soon to be stars. And, I mean, it's sort of like they go out to Calderon. There's a bus. They arrest him. He gets out on $1 million bail and posts the bail in cash, and that gives you sort of your clue that Tubbs wants to stick around with the Miami Vice Division, and because he's actually from armed robbery from the NYPD. He's from the armed robbery division, and you know, is totally out of his element.
John, let me ask you something, Tubbs. Close to Tib? Yeah. Close to Tibbs, you reckon? Like Sidney Poitier?
Maybe.
Bit of a slight nod.
Well, the thing is, his name is Ricardo. So I was thinking, did they intend him to possibly be like Puerto Rican or, you know, or Hispanic? And they got Philip Michael Thomas, who could do different accents, and he could sort of play him as, you know, like he could still be a convincing like half black, half Hispanic or something. Like, boy, you want to talk about somebody who's not aged? Philip Michael Thomas, frightening.
Yeah, I'm just looking at him now. I was like, holy shit, he barely aged a day. So
he just looks like if he has a beard, he looks like Philip Michael Thomas with like a Santa Claus beard on.
Yeah,
like there's no wrinkle. There's nothing. It's like
I don't get it, John. Yeah, I don't get it. I don't get these guys. Philip Michael Thomas, I'm looking at the picture you're talking about with the Santa Claus beard. Mel Gibson. Okay. Let's call it for what it is. Two really good looking guys. But they wear those fucking beards that aged them about 20 years. Why? I don't get it. I mean,
maybe it's for respect. I don't know.
Fuck your respect. Don't worry about that shit. Just try and look young. I mean,
maybe their wives like it. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Or maybe they're looking jolly, you know, under the chin. I don't know.
So you want to age 15 to 20 years by wearing a fucking gray beard, really? I don't get it.
That's all you got to do. Maybe it's the parts they want to play. Philip Michael Thomas is retired, which I respect. It's like, I think it's actually cool that he just says, oh, I'm retired.
Yeah, that'll do. Yeah. Yeah. But what did you think of this as a pilot movie?
I think it's a great setup. It was really fun to see it again. The whole driving to the drug bus to the theme of a Phil Collins.
Is
iconic. It actually makes that song seem a lot cooler and edgier than it actually is. And probably define that song, to tell you the truth.
I think so.
And yeah, definitely. It's the Miami Vice song now. I like the Jan Hammer music. I thought the location work in Miami was really cool. Like, they obviously film there, and you see these kind of seedy neighborhoods and dives and everything. Some of the weird stuff with the gun tactics, and I think it's just an image thing, but like Tubbs carries a double-barreled shotgun sawed off. And I don't know why you would have that in a shootout with guys with MAC-10s.
Yeah.
Because you basically got two shots, and you got to do a fast reload. So I didn't really understand that, but I think they thought it looked cool, and it'd be like, oh, it'd be like Miami Vice, you're like Mad Max. It's got a sawed off double barrel shotgun, you know.
That's because Australians don't know shit about guns, so it's like, oh, this looks nasty, so we'll use this.
Yeah, exactly. It looks like he's holding a big cannon, you know. But really he's got something you don't want in a gunfight for a tactical weapon. And Don Johnson, his character, uses the Bren 10, which I don't think they manufactured after like 1986 or something, which fired a 10 millimeter bullet and apparently was a much loved gun among gun fanatics. But apparently the one they used on the show, they modified to fire like 45 ACP bullets or something. So because 10 millimeters are probably tough to get, especially for blanks for a TV show.
You realize what you just said just going way over my head, right?
Okay, well, it's tactical stuff. So.
Yeah.
But I was actually in a gun safety class, an NRA gun safety class, and the teacher mentioned Don Johnson and his Bren 10 in Miami Vice because he holds it in a peculiar way, which is it's also similar to the way Bruce Willis holds guns in movies. Like he's got the gun in front of him with both hands, and he kind of like lets the gun guide him when he's sneaking around a corner or whatever. But
yeah.
Don Johnson does it the same way. But it, yeah, it was funny, like being in a gun class and somebody brings up Don Johnson in Miami Vice. Just like,
yeah. You mentioned the Jan Hammer theme. It is good, but it's not quite there yet. With these two episodes, it's a variation of what became the legendary theme song, which I've got to say, I really like that theme a lot. I put it up right up there with the Professionals theme. As being one of the best TV theme songs for a cop show. Great. Yeah.
Oh, it's classic. I loved it back then. It was really exciting when the title hit and everything, and it looked like that, you know, and it wasn't, you didn't get, unlike other action cop shows at the time, you didn't get that montage of your leads in action. Like, you know, it looks like the Beastie Boys Sabotage video.
Yep.
It's like, you know,
exactly.
Now Manics, like now they're jumping around the corner. Now they're diving on the car, you know, now
yeah.
they're in karate class, you know, whatever. It's like here, it's just like shots of Miami and chicks in bikinis and
yeah.
The sports of Miami and speedboats and flamingos and everything. It's a perfect setup. It's like a movie. And that was so exciting at the time. Probably a Gen Z type watching it today would not know what we went crazy for back then. But it's like You would have to have understood that TV cop shows and action shows, it was the Fall Guy and kind of this stuff that just didn't come off like this, didn't play like this, you know?
Yep, that's right.
Didn't look like an R-rated film. You could see it at your local theater.
Yeah. Have you ever been to Miami before?
Never been there.
Never been there. Been to Florida?
I've been to Florida. I lived in Florida for a little while, but I never went to Miami. When I was a little kid, we went to Disney World, but I believe that's, Eric says it's actually on the outskirts of Orlando. It's not actually in Orlando, but I went to Disney World, but I have memories of that, but I've never been to Miami. I lived in Northeast Florida, or no, it was Northwest Florida. It was called the Panhandle. It's where they filmed a really good Peter Fonda movie called Yuli's Gold. It's set there.
Oh, okay.
And it's actually a pretty accurate portrayal of the Panhandle of Florida, the Northwest.
Okay, because I'm starting to get interested in Miami now from watching this show. I mean, obviously it's changed. It's more of a party town these days, isn't it? Like a party city.
I'd probably have to ask Eric. He would give you the real skinny on that.
I guess so. But
yeah, I tried to get him on the show, but he had not seen the pilot in a while and did not have access to it.
Oh, okay. No worries. And doesn't Garrow live in Miami now, or is he elsewhere?
I think he lives in Spring Hill. I'd have to call him and ask. But he does live. He's not far from Miami, wherever he lives. I think he's close to Tampa. I'm not sure. I'm sure he's laughing right now hearing this.
I'm out of Boston. Who cares?
Yeah, I think he's just glad to be out of Massachusetts. Yeah. You know? Or as he would say, a fucking blue state.
But isn't Florida a blue state or is it a swing state?
It's a red state.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Ron DeSantis, their governor, he's like the big anti-Democrat governor right now. He's very popular. And every month or so, a show like 60 Minutes, a news magazine, will post like, you know, they'll present like some hatchet piece on
yeah,
him.
A hit job.
It'll just totally backfire because the guy's been pretty solid during the Branch Covidian nonsense of last year. He was pretty solid. Every decision he made turned out to be the right one, and they were doing everything they could to demonize him. And I know there's a lot of Republicans that hope he'll run for president in the next election because he could probably, you know, he'd probably could easily win.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't even...
Florida has become the hot state to move to. Like, all these people are leaving the blue states and trying to move to Florida. I think Gara said the house he bought in Florida, I think he said it was on the market for 2 hours.
Jesus.
And the real estate agent said, we sell these houses before they're finished being built within hours of listing them. She said the mass influx of people moving to Florida is crazy.
My goodness. I'm really keen to go there now. I'm going to see what Florida's like.
So you've never been there in your travels?
No. I've only ever been to my two travels to the US has been Las Vegas. Sadly, I was in California for 24 hours. I couldn't get out of there fast enough. Mm-hmm. It was like, ugh, not a fan of that place. No offense to people who live in California, but it was scary. Las Vegas,
yeah.
Texas, Memphis, and Boston. That's all I've been to. But Florida, yeah, I'd like to go. I'd like to see it. It's very... isn't there a big Cuban population over there somewhere in Florida, or is it right throughout Florida?
I believe in Miami. Miami's real big with the Cuban population.
Okay, Miami. All right.
Yeah. Of which Eric is actually Cuban, so...
No. Oh, really? Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Thought he was German.
No.
No, I'm just
Cuban saying. And, you know, probably a mixture of whatever, you know, the Cubans or whatever.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I really enjoy this pilot. I think I had a lot more love for it before because I think what I'm doing is I'm mixing up parts of this and parts of the Calderon Returns movie and meshing them together. I'm thinking it's a lot better than what it really is. But, I mean, don't get me wrong, I enjoy it. I mean... When I get my rating, I'll give it a decent rating. But I'm thinking of particular... Because I was sitting there waiting for Edward James Olmos to roll up and going, why is his name not in the credits? Okay, maybe he's a special guest star on the end credits. Didn't turn up. So, right. I'm mishmashing parts of this and parts of that and sort of forming my own movie in my head.
Yeah, because instead you got Julio from Sanford and Son telling Crockett and Tubbs they needed to team up.
Yeah, who wasn't very good, that guy. I didn't like him a great deal. I think
he's kind of bland. I think they wanted something more of a contrast when they got Edward James Olmos to, the what would you call it? I don't know that type of acting that Don Johnson and Philip Michael Thomas are engaging in, that kind of Stella Adler type of acting or whatever.
Yeah.
That Brando-esque, I don't know, Brando or Pacino inspired, I don't know.
But of the three actors, Olmos is the best by a country mile, actually. I think he is.
People say that. I remember everybody praising him back then, but I don't know. I just my dad kind of mocked what type of actor he was. He just says one word, and he's just kind of doing the Bronson-type acting. The only thing else I remember about Edward James Olmos is I remember Harvey Keitel accused him of molesting his daughter.
Oh, Jesus. Really?
Yeah, that was a real thing. Lorraine Bracco had divorced Harvey Keitel.
Yep.
And she was with Edward James Olmos, living with him, and Keitel, I think, got custody of his daughter and claimed Olmos had molested her.
Okay. I mean, it may happen, but claims...
Yeah, that, I mean, it's one of those... It's an ugly divorce situation, so no idea what's real and what isn't, you know, because it's accusations, but he did make that accusation.
Mm.
He touched my daughter! You know.
old Harvey. Yeah, the overacting king. But I did enjoy Almost an American Me. I thought that was a great movie. It was a really good movie, that one.
Yeah, I've never seen it. I know it apparently set a record for prison rape, according to the Gore Gazette or something.
Did it really? Yeah.
I don't know. I've never seen it. So I don't. Blood In, Blood Out, I thought was pretty hilarious with that aspect. But
yeah, American Me was a tough movie to watch. It's not easy to watch, but it was good. Very, very good movie. Mm-hmm. But yeah, with this one, I mean, I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. I'm going to watch Calderon's Return tomorrow throughout the day. I'm flat out the rest of the day today. And see from there which one's the better of the two movies, if you will.
Right. So you refer to it as a movie. Over here, we just knew it as a two-part episode.
I mean,
Prodigal Son and Calderon's Return or something.
Like yeah. I mean, it is... It's on the DVD is... Two episodes, not a actual. It's not a movie like they did with the Incredible Hulk. They did a few movies first. They did a pilot movie. Then he did the...
Yeah, they were aired as... Those were aired as movies, because I remember those airing as movies.
Oh, Incredible Hulk Returns played here at the drive-in when it came out in 79 or 78. No,
I remember it was a CBS movie special, and which was basically an excuse to show a 90-minute, two-parter or whatever.
I'll tell you what played the drive-in was the Incredible Hulk one I mentioned, and there was also one that I did actually go and see, but I remember the Hulk one playing at the drive-in, but I didn't go. But I did go and see a two-part Amazing Spider-Man, or Spider-Man, the one with Nicholas Hammond, which got cut into a movie, and I saw that at the drive-in. So that would have been about 78, I think, 79 at the most. 78 it would have been. Two seasons of that show, or three?
There were two short seasons.
Okay, so
there were some movie specials that aired, a couple of movie specials aired, and they were later repackaged as two-part episodes when they aired it in they aired it on CBS, and it was actually a ratings hit, contrary to what revisionist history will say. But they kept moving the time slot around, and it became tough to keep up with, and then the ratings started dropping. But they had a couple of two-part episodes. The first one was shown as a movie special, so it was like 2 hours. Yeah. And I know in syndication they were edited back into two-hour, 90-minute movies or whatever.
Right. So I think the first one was the one I saw at the drive-in. But yeah, really enjoyed it. But what the hell is the hold-up with Spider-Man coming to home video?
I don't know. I was curious about that myself, and... It's funny because I watched on Disney Plus, there was they have a documentary series about Marvel stuff, and most of it is just bugman garbage, but they had one about the Japanese Spider-Man show, and they had clips from the Nicholas Hammond series, and the quality was terrible. Like, they pulled it off of YouTube. So my guess is nobody knows about the official rights to that series, because I figured Disney would have cleared that up and at least put out like a DVD set or something, and nobody knows. I don't think anybody knows, because it's probably trapped between two or three production companies and CBS and Disney.
Well, Spider-Man itself was wrapped up in a rights nightmare for years.
Yeah, Sony might actually have some say in it. I don't know, but they couldn't even pull good-looking episodes up for a Disney retrospective show. So I was like, wow.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah. I've heard there was Avi Arad, who's just keeping a suppression sort of lead on it, saying, nope, it's not coming out because it's that bad. Come off if they can release other shit on home video.
I prefer some of the movies. I mean, it's better than some of the Spider-Man movies.
I agree. I totally agree. Know? But, it's 70s tripe, really. Let's call it for what it is. But it's enjoyable.
It's not great. It's like watching the George Reeves Superman show. You will have people tell you that was like the greatest TV show of all time, and then you watch it. It's like, it's a kid's show. It was designed to sell Frosted Flakes.
Yeah, and every damn week he's saving Lois Lane. If I was Superman, I'd be like, bitch, you're on your own. I'm not saving you every week. Yeah, this is ridiculous.
It gets ridiculous, and nobody recognizes him as Clark without glasses. It's just kind of silly.
Yeah, I know. Speaking of that, I mean, going back to this Miami Vice, when Philip Michael Thomas is confronted by the hooker in the street... He couldn't tell that wasn't a guy in drag, really, in the laneway. That was ridiculous.
Yeah, it was kind of that's they push credibility when they have stuff like that. It's really hard believability with that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and Crockett just happened to turn up at that laneway at that time. It's like, okay. Let's suspend disbelief a little bit here with this one. You know, you can't tell it's a guy in drag, and then Crockett just rolls up from anywhere in Miami into that laneway at that time.
Yeah, right, it's not whatever. It's not perfect writing when you watch it. It's TV writing back then was there was this tough way of let's get our heroes together, before the next commercial break, the way they write it in segments and stuff, and they have to come up with contrived nonsense, I think, sometimes to get this going. Or something that strains credibility.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's a good starting point for the series, which I think progressively gets better throughout the first. And the season two is really, really good as well. It's they really hit their strides with that one. But anyway, we're going to call it a day shortly. So we'll rate this, John.
What are you going to give the Miami Vice pilot movie slash two episode?
I give it a 7 because I have fond memories of watching it in 84. I enjoyed watching it, the summer rerun. I watched the summer rerun later the following year. And yeah. I think I watched it when USA Network reran this in, I think, believe the 90s, and I enjoyed it. And so watching it, I watched it again in like 2011 or 12 when my wife found me the box set with the fake alligator skin coating on the box.
Which you now know goes for a lot of money, right? It goes for a lot of money, that set.
What's that?
It goes for a lot of money. Does it? Yes, it does.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Well, this is what's funny. She found it at a now defunct chain of stores called Alco. She found it for $15.
Oh, wow.
Never opened. Yeah, and she also found me the complete Incredible Hulk set with the big giant green box with the, you know, with the letters up.
Yeah.
And a 3D puff effect. And it was like $15 or something. It was some ridiculously cheap price. And she called me and said, "Hey, I found these. Do you want them?" I go, yes, I would love to have those, you know. And I watched it then and still liked it, even though I kind of laughed at some of the writing. But I watched it again last Monday, and I really dug it. I was like, wow, this is pretty fun, and it's very well set up, and, you know, these characters aren't wimps. I mean, obviously, Johnson and Philip Michael Thomas are really – they're kind of overacting to steal the scenes because this is like their last chance to shine in a TV pilot.
Yeah.
And they both kind of overdo it. I think they got more – settled and relaxed in their characters as the show went on, because the follow-up episode is a lot less hammy, and with the one with Ed O'Neill as the guy who's gone too far into the undercover, and Susie Amos is actually the girl in the beginning in the porn shoot, later became somewhat of a popular, semi-popular actress, and
very
but
sweaty.
I enjoyed it, so I give it a 7. I was surprised.
Yeah, I've got the same. I've got a 7 for this one. I think it's well worth your time for 91 minutes, 92 minutes that it is. Like I said, Calderon's Return, I am going to watch tomorrow. And I do want to watch the Crime Story one, but I think I might save that for when we do the Crime Story pilot. I think we should do that one.
Right.
And just sort of put them back, to, you know, put them up against each other. I got a feeling the Crime Story one's a bit better from memory. But again, my memory's jaded because I thought this one was, you know, like hitting an 8 or a 9. But it's not bad. Don't get me wrong. It's still a fun watch.
I love Crime Story when that was on. I actually preferred it to Miami Vice at the time. But, you know, what I would think of it now, I don't know. I went back and rewatched them about 15, 16 years ago, and I thought it was still a pretty good show. It's just... I think the problem was they decided to have the same villain in the entire series, and that just sort of makes the cops look inept.
Yeah,
you know, after a while,
basically,
and that's the only flaw of the show. You know, I love the acting in it, and I thought that the look of it was great and everything, the music. But it'll be interesting to revisit. But the cool thing about this is now I'm inspired to finally watch this rare Miami Vice box set I have and throw an episode into my mix of watching the shows I watch every week. So
nice.
This will be alternating with Mannix and Wild Wild West and the Professionals and the Avengers and all these other things I watch, you know, watching an episode here and there. And that'll be in the rotation.
Watch the one with the Haitian witch doctor.
Is that like third season or something, or fourth season?
I'll let you know, but it's much later into the series. It's like,
there was one I loved. My favorite episode, they went to rescue a kidnapped little girl in like a swamp. It was like these drug dealers had kidnapped a girl, and they were hiding in this this house in the swamp. And basically, Crockett and Tubbs team up with some local like swamp rats, like rednecks, and go in there and rescue her. And it was like the best shootout on the show. Like, and this old man said he had his gator gun, he had this large barrel like shotgun or whatever, muzzle loader, and he shoots, of course, the bad guy at the end. And it's like it was he said, "This is my gator gun," and then he shoots the bad guy in the finale. But it was pretty cool. I remember that being a great episode.
Right All right, man, let's wrap it up, because I'm about to go to bed and crash out some more. I'm just fucked. All right, you can catch us on the usual places. You'll hear my dulcet tones over the end. Credits, giving you all the information there. I am actually checking the Midnight Movie Cowboys email a bit more regularly than what I have been, because there was some episode requests from 2019 last time I looked. It's like, oh shit, I better check this.
Oh my god.
Yeah, I'm sure this person now is like, oh fuck these guys, I don't bother answering emails, so they can go to hell. Oh, and also, not up and running yet, but the Patreon, John. We've got one set up with our name. And
we set up a fucking Patreon, huh?
Yeah, we did. So, like I said, don't look for it there yet. It is set, but it's hidden away. It's not for the public's gaze just yet. I wanted to come back, speak to Hunter and John, and we will start getting some Patreon shit out. It will not be on the iTunes feed at all. So, be able to join up for a couple of bucks a month, $5 a month, and get some cool exclusive shit. But that's further down the track. So, before my head hits the table here and I can't get up, I'm going to say, have a good one.
I say, peace out.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.